Namaste. A brief review of Sri Aurobindo's life. Why should we know about Sri Aurobindo's life when we have the yoga and the yoga practice? Well, to read the life of the great ones at once inspires us, and when we read his life, it sets before us a divine example. It is not always easy or simple to understand the yoga and the practice, but when we hear about his life, when we read about his life, it gives us a clarity about the way to be followed without ever telling us what to do. By his own acts, by his own deeds, he shows us the way. So inspiration and example are there. At the same time, when we read the life of avatars who have set before us the divine example, it is very purifying. It has its own effect upon human nature. It becomes a yoga in its own right. Because what else is yoga but coming in contact with the divine? And as we see, as is there in Indian tradition, through the guru, through the avatar, the divine representative in humanity. So when we read Sri Aurobindo's life, when we dwell upon his life, we come in closer contact with Sri Aurobindo, and as a result, we have some kind of contact established between our human consciousness and the divine consciousness in Sri Aurobindo. And that is not only purifying but transformative, and it is a yoga in its own right. So from that perspective, we can turn to Sri Aurobindo's life. Now generally when there is a talk on the life of anyone, great ones of course, we have a tendency to recount the outer events. And outer events have their own place. But as we know, the outer events derive their significance from the inner consciousness. As Sri Aurobindo says, the greatness of a human being does not lie in what his outer position is, but in what he inwardly is and becomes. So, and we have number of examples, because if you look at outer life of Sri Aurobindo, you have certain incidents, you have certain events, but when we look at his inner life, and behind the inner life and inmost life, life exists in all these three layers. There is the outer life with its outer personality and the outer events, and behind it is the inner life, which shows the many-sided directions in which the inner being is moving. And behind the inner life, there is a yet deeper inner life where we see the divine qualities, the devi qualities, which constitute the real man, as Sri Aurobindo says, the inner man. And behind this inner life, we see the soul shining. And the purpose of reading Sri Aurobindo's life or dwelling upon Sri Aurobindo's life should be eventually from the outer to touch the inmost core. Of course, those who are very fortunate and lucky and specially blessed by the grace, they come in contact with this inmost core. As the mother said, the divine is what you adore in Sri Aurobindo. But, well, even then, his outer life itself is something marvelous, something wonderful. So when we look at Sri Aurobindo's outer life, we see, of course, the events are well known. First 7 years is in India, in Darjeeling, born to a doctor father, Krishnadan Ghosh, and his wife, Swarnalata Devi, who was daughter of Rishi Raj Narayan Bose, a well-known name in India, known for his deep and great ideas and whose influence was there on Sri Aurobindo as a child. But at the same time, he goes to St. Paul in Darjeeling, where he is brought under a kind of Christian education. And at one point, mother says that both Sri Aurobindo and myself had to struggle against this Christian conception of a God who is up above there and from where he is deciding things. Both of them, because he also in his early years went to St. Paul's, and his father, he believed, like many of those days, that well, ultimately, who is great? The great is he who succeeds. And the British Empire had established itself. So it was taken as a kind of axiomatic truth that because the British Empire has succeeded, that means there is something very right about their ways, their culture. And hence he wanted his son to be thoroughly anglicized. He didn't want him to be exposed to anything India and Indian. So at 7, young Shervindo, if you look at his picture, the mother says, there is such a purity. Actually, there is such a purity. Just looking at Shervindo's picture, I think it's at the age of 10. There is a picture even earlier. And he travels all the way to England, to London, where he is brought up by a Druids family. And of course, though they were told that, they are not supposed to learn about Christianity, but it's inevitable. So he was even baptized. He was taken to a church where he was baptized. There is a very interesting story that they sprinkled some water and Shrivindra is watching everything amused, and then they say, suddenly he is saved. So he described that story. And at the Druid's place, he learns Latin first, because it was compulsory to learn Latin before you can get admission in English school. So he learns Latin and English and French, and later on he also learns Spanish, Italian, German and French. So 7 languages, and of course she was an Irish woman, so of course Irish is English but with its own unique accent. So all these Shrivindo learns as a brilliant student. But even as a student, he is, of course, he is a scholar in the sense that he has learned things so quickly. So a brilliant scholar, but he is not a scholar of the academic kind. Shrivindo himself once remarked that I may not have read so much, but I have made a lot of what I have read. So he would go to the core of things, and that one can see later on in his life when he is a teacher and he is speaking of the life of Nelson, and one of the students says this in Baroda, that sir, but this not written in the books, and he says throw the book out of the window, because he had another way of looking at things. And so his brilliance was not just academic but something deeper than that. And so he blossoms as a brilliant student. But even while he is learning these languages, we see a budding poet. His first poem, which is published under the title Light, at the age of 10 or 11. And this poem, though one may say that it sounds something like Shelley's, you can imagine, being compared to a poet like that. But a child of 10 or 11 writing that poem, it's almost like in the mold of an avatar who is foreseeing the future. So at 10 or 11, Shrivindo writes this poem, and later on he writes poetry. And at the same time, along with this budding poet, he sees Songs to Mithila. Many of his poems are written in England. And they're very deep, beautiful, lyrical poems. There's a touch of romanticism in them. And also there is a sympathy with the Irish movement. There is a feeling for those who are, downtrodden. All this you can begin to see forming in Shrivindo's personality. One can also see in those poems a reflection of his growing love for the motherland. And when he describes the cuckoo whom she is missing, when he speaks in Envoy about his departure, he is not feeling sad at departure from England, but he is rather feeling happy that she has been called by Mother Saraswati. Me from her lotus heaven, Saraswati has called to regions of eternal snow. So he writes that. And one of the reasons that it is said that his love for motherland grew is also because his father began to get disillusioned from the empire. And so he used to send him paper cuttings of the atrocities of the empire. Be it as it may, of course he was destined to play a very large role. So we also see a budding, not only a poet, but also a patriot. And along with that, we also see a budding thinker, philosopher, and an author. And one of his writings, The Harmony of Virtue, which is a play written at the age of 18, is amazing because it's very deep, profound ideas, philosophical ideas, and the way they are presented. And, it's fairly long, I think about 60 pages, and it's an amazing piece of writing that we see there. So we see a poet, a thinker, a philosopher, a budding patriot. And we also glimpse the seed of spirituality. And that's when he describes that one of his first spiritual experiences is when at the age of 18 he read from the Upanishads, one of the translations of the Upanishads, a poor translation. But reading it, he had an experience of the self. Later on he describes it was an experience in the mind. This used to have those unique terminology. Somebody else would say, I had the self, experience of the self. But Sri Aurobindo says that before you have the real experience, you can have these reflections in the mind of that self, like the sun reflecting in a calm lake. And many people would take it as the ultimate experience, but Sri Aurobindo speaks of it. So already he was getting conversant with the Isha Upanishad and this experience of the self, and maybe some other experiences which he has not spoken about. Always I feel that in any biography, one should know that there is a large part which remains hidden. Many sights and sounds and thoughts and feelings which would have arisen. For example, for a whole year he had to go with just one coat and we know the winter of England, and just one meal, that too, one saveloy and a cup of tea in a day. And what would have gone on in the mind and heart of a child? Because his father couldn't send enough money, but he wanted him and his two brothers. There were four of them, but three were in England and Barin was in India. So he wanted them to receive a thoroughly English education. And Sri Aurobindo understood it. He never had anything but love for his father. One can see that he never felt that, why my father didn't. No bitterness at all. So you can see that sweetness in his picture. So with all this background and preparation, now Sri Aurobindo is preparing. He has finished his studies in Manchester and London. And then he gets at the recommendation of Oscar Browning, he gets admission in Cambridge. And that's where he studies at the King's College, Cambridge. And he is now appearing for the ICS exam, where he appears for the tripos and gets first class first. And yet his calling is to India. His heart is already beginning to be in India. So he drops out of the riding test. So that is something very interesting. And so he leaves the lucrative ICS position. Horse riding test was largely a formality, because with that kind of performance, all that he needed was, he didn't have to run a horse race just to know the basics of driving. But he drops out. And so he sails to India, where the Maharaja of Baroda, who has already met him in London, has already recruited him as an officer in the Land Settlement Department. So he joins the Baroda State Service, giving up on ICS. We see the beginnings of a renunciate. And he joins the Baroda Princely State Service. It's a state service which has not surrendered itself to the British Empire. That is something very interesting. So he joins there first as the Revenue and Land Settlement Department. And there we see that Sri Aurobindo, despite all his brilliance and qualification, he is not, he is fine with that. And the way he works, the meticulousness with which he has kept the accounts, the meticulousness with which he takes up things, they are all there on record, and something very amazing. So, but seeing his exceptional capacities, so Baroda Maharaja also uses him to write his speeches. So at one time, Sri Aurobindo writes his speeches, which are wonderful documents about the medical establishment, about the political things, industries, etc. So Baroda Maharaj says, your writing is too good. Nobody will believe that I have written it. And Sri Aurobindo says that anyways, nobody will believe that Maharaja writes speeches. So they will anyways take it that somebody else is writing. So you might as well express what I have written. So always we see in Sri Aurobindo this touch of humor which sparkles suddenly. And so he wrote the speeches for the Maharaja, and yet he maintained his independence. Whenever the Maharaja would call him for the parties, he would not be going, because he was by nature reticent, solitude lover. We can't call him literally an introvert, because he had friends. He would also go for cricket. He wouldn't play much, but yes, he went for cricket and he would spend time with friends. Sometimes they would play cards, but he was by and large a lover of solitude. not one of those with too many friends, going out exuberant. So during this period, as soon as Aurobindo comes, he started participating in the revolutionary activities. As soon as he came, and he started participating by writing articles for the Hindu Prakash, and these articles is 1893, 6 February, Aurobindo comes to India. He's 21-year-old lad and he's writing articles which are of such a nature that they are literally challenging the British Empire. And those who read it, even those who requested him to write, they start requesting him, see, these are too fiery and they will draw the attention of the British Empire. And he says that's the purpose, to draw the attention. No, it will call their wrath and it'll create difficulties and problems. So they ask him to tone down. But Aurobindo, being a traveler of truth, pilgrim of truth, he preferred to slowly dwindle down and stop writing rather than, you know, tone down his writings. He tried, but then he gave up the effort. But then what did he do at that point of time? It's a period when he prepared himself for the revolutionary movement, for freedom of India, but in a very interesting way. So we see that there is another well-known freedom fighter or revolutionary or to whom the crown is given. And we know that when he came to India, he prepared for the revolutionary movement. He went all across India to understand India. Okay, so we have this idea that you must travel, meet people. But Aurobindo did a very different approach. He plunged into the soul of India. Because if you don't know the soul of India, you'll know only the surface, you'll know the country as it is today. And at that point of time, the country was asleep. Because after 1857, when Rani Lakshmi Bai and the whole freedom movement with Mangal Pandey, all this, you know, the revolt, that had died down, and then the country had gone off almost into sleep. So Aurobindo plunged himself into a study of the Vedas, the Upanishads, and the Gita in a very different way to understand the soul of India. And along with that, his spiritual journey also we see continuing, the budding author and the poet, all of these began to blossom. So we see some remarkable poetry, some long poems like Love and Death, shorter poems, many of them written in Baroda period, Pururavas, and all of them, Baji Prabhu has a touch of what it means to sacrifice. And at the same time, he studies now English, Indian languages, because he has already mastered some 7 odd foreign languages. And now he masters slowly Bengali, which is his mother tongue, Hindi, Marathi, Gujarati. I think these are the 4 languages for sure. And there is one more language, which Sanskrit. Yes, of course. So Sanskrit, Hindi, Bengali, Gujarati and Marathi. So these are the languages he could read and write. Some he could speak a little bit. Bengali he could speak a little bit. And I think Gujarati he could speak a little bit. Sanskrit he would not speak, but he could read and write. So with that study of Sanskrit, he plunged into the literature, Indian literature, like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, straight away, with that Sanskrit. And he actually picked up Sanskrit from there. That's how Aurobindo describes that he learned Sanskrit largely from coming in contact with the classical text, of which Valmiki's Ramayana, Vyas Mahabharata and text of Kalidas, some of whom he has translated portions. That was his way, plunging into the very heart of things. So later on, of course, all this will blossom still further. And the revolutionary, after about 7-8 years of preparation, say from 1893 to 1900, he also launched on a mega venture. So he started writing a poem called Earth and Beyond, which will later on ultimately consummate itself in Savitri. So it was based on the story of Savitri, but it was a long poem, but only in 2 parts, Earth and the Beyond. So this also starts in Baroda during that time. And then 1901 is a kind of changeover. And that during that period, we see 1901, Aurobindo gets married to Mrilalini Devi. Hardly had a life of a householder with her. And her story is, of course, an amazing story in her own right. So 1901, he is married. And 1902, he begins to actively participate, a little more actively in the independence movement, but from behind. So he forms the Anushilan Samiti. There are revolutionaries who come from Bengal, and there were those in the state of Baroda from Maharashtra. So he started forming little groups and to prepare the plan for a revolutionary overthrowing of the British Empire. And his brother, who had not gone to England, who studied in India, Barin, who was also a journalist and of course an author, he joined him. So at his behest, we see around 1905, Shrivindu writes a pamphlet called Bhavani Bharati. It's a very powerful pamphlet where Shrivindu analyzes the cause of India's decline. And he says it's because of want of Shakti. He says we have Bhakti, we have Jnana, Karma also to an extent, but we are missing in Shakti. We have rejected Shakti, and so the Shakti has rejected us. And so he awakens the Shakti of Bharat, and during that time he writes a poem in Sanskrit, a long poem of 100 verses or 99 verses, Bhavani Bharati, where he describes Mother Kali appearing before him in a vision, and she points out that, look, the Asura is sitting on your mother's breast. Would you not wake up and call forth, my call has gone forth to all the children to wake up and collaborate. So we see that the transition is taking place and he's beginning to participate more and more. In 1906, because a national college was being formed in Kolkata, and it was requested by Raja Subodh Malik that if Sri Aurobindo comes and takes over as its principal, then he would start it. So Sri Aurobindo agrees to go there. He was already by then the acting principal in Baroda, and he had also been a vice principal there. He was also teaching French and English. So he goes to the National College in Kolkata, and a new chapter begins in Sri Aurobindo's life. This is life as a revolutionary. So here we see that Sri Aurobindo again acts along several lines. National education means preparing the youth. So he's preparing the youth for the country along with organizing small little groups to prepare for, if necessary, an armed revolt. So he was neither an inveterate pacifist nor he was an apologist for violence. He believed that independence is important of India, Swaraj, for the sake of the world. So his idea behind the independence movement was not just it's my country and it should be freed. Well, of course, every country has a right to achieve freedom. But his purpose was, his idea was that if India achieves freedom, then India can have its rightful place in the world, because a country which is politically subject cannot be spiritually free fully. And unless India is spiritually and politically free, it cannot play its true role to free the world from the shackles of ignorance. This is how Sri Aurobindo's whole logic went. And therefore, Swaraj for him meant two things. One was self-rule, India's independence, but also Swaraj, he meant that those who are Indians, who are participating in the movement, first they must achieve self-mastery. So yoga was inbuilt into his freedom movement. Spirituality was as if running as the sap, the stream, and we see in all his writings and speeches. So he started editing the newspaper, Vande Mataram, and he wrote also for Yugantar. Unfortunately, those writings are lost. And then in the Bengali paper, Dharma, where he wrote in Bengali, and of course, Karmi Yogi. But in all of them, we see spiritual nationalism for the first time appearing before world. He fused and synthesized two things which seem nearly impossible to fuse, spirituality and politics. So literally, he spiritualized politics. But then naturally, Sri Aurobindo also realized that he is moving far ahead of his times, because he must have seen the way people were, and therefore at one point of time he was developing this thought that he should withdraw into some other kind of work. But he would not leave it. So he would, because love for the country as a true patriot, so he was laying down the large lines along which India would eventually get freedom. So if we read through the Vande Mataram, we'll see all the things: passive boycott, passive resistance, boycott, Swadeshi, to which he added national education, which was not taken up, unfortunately, as a program. So all these are non-cooperation. All these are the lines which were later taken up by, the Indian National Congress later on. And, well, India got freedom. So he had laid down all the lines. Inwardly, he was feeling more and more as if he has a calling to some other field. His spiritual consciousness was growing. He had remarkable experiences. For instance, his rigorous practice of pranayama. Suddenly he had an opening and hundreds of lines, 200 lines at a time of poem would flow into him. So he had experienced those results in 1905. He had experience of the vacant infinite while walking on the Takht-e-Suleiman in Kashmir. He had the experience of the world mother in Chandod, in Karnali, in the temple of Kali. I mean, it's not a temple of Kali, but looking at Kali's image. He had the experience of the world mother again when he goes to Saraspag in Pune. So spiritual experiences were beginning to flow into him. And his growing closeness with the sense of Kali, which we see very prominently in Sri Aurobindo's life, as if he is identifying himself with Kali during the revolutionary movement. And obviously at some point of time, Sri Krishna entered the play and he draws him to Alipur jail. It's very paradoxical because he is going to Alipur jail under charges of sedition. Before that, he already had the experience of Nirvana in 1907. So we see all the dimensions are blooming, beginning to bloom. And in the experience of Nirvana, he describes Yogi Vishnu Bhaskar Lele, who was a Vaishnava. And on in 1908, beginning in January 7th, he was brought home by Barin. Basically, because Sri Aurobindo wanted to practice yoga now more intensively, so that he can get Shakti. Why Shakti? Because he wanted to liberate his motherland. And he knew that yoga gives Shakti. He already had these experiences. But Vishnu Bhaskar Lele just told him that sit quietly, sit in silence, see the thoughts that are coming from different sides, and you throw them away. And Sri Aurobindo sits in silence for 3 days. And he does it, and he describes later on how he could do it. He said, one, he had this spirit of surrender to the Guru. That, well, if he is the master, he is teaching you, give yourself. So he surrendered to his instruction, not to him, but to his instruction. Why not to him? Because he had surrendered already to the world mother. That we see in some of his own utterances. When Sister Nivedita tells him that, the British are after you and you should leave Kolkata immediately. This is before his sedition charges. He says, you know better than me that the world mother has taken me in her hands. So how can I leave without her explicit instructions? So he had surrendered himself to the divine mother, but he had taken instructions from Lele. And because some kind of practice and the results that he achieved as a result of that practice was something that even Lele was not, it was difficult even for him to comprehend. So it was very unexpected. His mind had become silent, completely silent and still, shoreless still. He describes it in one of his poems, Nirvana. And then Lele asked him that, do you feel the presence in your heart? And he says, yes, he became conscious of the imminent divine Vasudev in his heart. And then he asked him, can you surrender yourself to him? He says, yes, I can surrender myself to him completely. So from then on, whatever Sri Aurobindo speaks, whenever he went to address a gathering, because even after that Nirvana experience, he continued works in the world, literally typifying that example which Sri Krishna speaks in the Gita, that Nirvana and works are not inconsistent with each other. So Sri Aurobindo, we see that he continued with this work. Even he engaged in the splitting of the Surat Congress. And he writes, he continued to do these editorials and writing for Bande Mataram, Dharma, Yugantar, Karma Yogin. And he gave number of speeches in that state. He went to Aurangabad, he went of course Surat and Pune and even he goes to Far East, many such places. And Nalanda, his trusted lieutenant, was one of them who accompanied him, and he describes that during that time people started regarding him as an avatar already. Maybe because of his countenance, his aura, his speeches, and when he would speak, people would hear in rapt pin drop silence. And some of these speeches given in different parts of Kolkata, they are all there already. So, and these speeches are so simple, so direct, as if somebody very sincerely is seeing things and he's speaking. And he's just presenting before the world something which he's seeing. And then, well, but as I said, Shri Krishna has other plans. So he is charged by the British government for sedition and he is put in Alipur jail, where he stays for 1 year. So that's a very amazing period when Sri Aurobindo, initially he is wondering that he wanted freedom of his country. But why is he in jail when he had unconditional protection of the Lord? And then the Lord appears before him, Vasudev, who is the indwelling universal. And he tells him, Krishna, wait and see. And then he realizes that a tendency, something was developing within him. But he was unable to break the bonds of his love for the motherland. And then Shri Krishna tells him that what you had to do in this field, you had already done. You have already done. Now you are required to do something which is much greater. The freedom of mankind awaits you, the emancipation of mankind from its slavery and bondage to ignorance. Not just by creating another cult, but by showing it the royal road to liberation and in the greatest possible, largest possible consummation of the human soul. So Sri Krishna comes and gives him the Gita. And Sri Aurobindo says that he placed the Gita in my hands. The strength of the Gita entered into him. The wisdom of the Gita entered into him. And he realized what Sri Krishna wants of those who turn to him. It's a very amazing Uttarpada speech which he gives. First speech when he comes out. And it's the only place where he speaks about his experiences so openly. It's a wonderful document. A document of Sri Aurobindo's vision. A mini document, seed document of Sri Aurobindo's vision and mission, as well as the vision and mission of India, both connected together in Uttarpada speech when he is released from Dalipur jail. Well, those 1 year, he has wonderful spiritual experiences, including seeing Sri Krishna everywhere. His yoga was moving at a very rapid pace. Miracles and siddhis, powers, they were flowing into him because he was a shakti in that way. He was seeking after shakti. And the shakti was entering him from every side, and they are remarkable, beautiful experiences, powerful experiences. And yet how Sri Aurobindo during those days, trying phase when he could be sent to either the, you know, gallows or to Andamans, we see Sri Aurobindo so beautifully, going through these experiences and looking at these experiences from a very different way. Because it is not an ordinary vision. It's the vision of how the divine would play with life and those dangerous circumstances. Much later he would say that, well, the going through dangerous circumstances when the sword of the empire was dangling over him. And the whole empire knew that he is the one who is behind all this awakening which has taken place. So from 1856, there was a deep lull. And with Sri Aurobindo's entry, almost 50 years, by 1907, we see a great awakening taking place. The soul of India has awakened. This, during that period, one of his last documents is the Durga Stroth. And after this awakening has taken place, and he comes out with all these experiences, he still waits for what next. And the what next orders come in March 1910. So he gets the orders to sail to Pondicherry, to Chandanagar. So he goes to Chandanagar, where he stays in Motilal Roy's house, mostly in an underground cellar, where again his spiritual life now begins to take more and more prominence. He converses with the gods. He is seeing visions. And there is that experience where Motilal Roy asks him, what are you staring at? And he says, the gods, they are making signs and gestures. And why, what is it? He says, they are trying to communicate something to me. And during that time, he starts seeing the Akashic records, going into the past and the future of the earth. And he has already started maintaining a journal, the records of yoga, which from 1909 he has started, soon after the release. Almost 1 year he stayed in Alipur jail. So 1909, on 7th May, he is released after 1 year. And 30th May is Uttarpada speech. And then he started keeping this journal because a lot of experiences and realizations were flowing into him. So during this period, suddenly one day he hears a voice, go to Chandanagar. He goes to Chandanagar, where he begins to converse with the gods. And they were real to him. They were not just symbols. They were not just personalities or abstractions. They were not just human creations. Certainly not imaginations. But they were real, true, and they were speaking to him. And so Sri Aurobindo learns what they have to teach him or tell him. And then he gets the orders from Chandanagar to sail to Pondicherry. So from there, under a name of Jyotindranath, which I have always found very interesting, because people often say, why did he take a name not his own? I said, maybe it is also his name, because Jyotindranath, who else but Sri Aurobindo could take this name? So he sails. Already two of the revolutionaries have come in advance to Pondicherry to keep some place for him, because it takes a time to set up things. He has to go get clearance, and the British government is after him. Chandanagar is a French territory, but he has to sail, and he has to go to an English doctor in Kolkata, and from Chandanagar he goes to Kolkata, and from Kolkata he takes the ship and travels to Pondicherry. On 4th April 1910, he set his foot on the soil of Pondicherry. And as the mother says, we can say that it is the day when, it is the day of the new year of Pondicherry. And also it is regarded as, by some, as the ashram's new year. Because Sri Aurobindo's coming itself is the sign of the dawn of a new age. So this part one, and we'll take up the other part later. And we see already here that the poet, the philosopher, the revolutionary, and the spiritual mystic, all these are blossoming to their fullest. But slowly we see that the spiritual stream is beginning to take over, and different sides of his personality are being fused under one single strand, and that is the spiritual consciousness that is awakened in him and is growing and towering towards pathless heights. Jai Ma.